Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have long admired the intelligence as well as the courage of our first guest, who has been both as a journalist and as an official in her government in Canada, extraordinarily robust in understanding and describing for the rest of us the kinds of challenges that we're facing from what I think of as Sharia supremacism. She is Christine Douglas Williams, a 9-time international award-winning journalist and television producer, who also served as a director in the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, from which she was summarily removed for her views, as well as an appointee in the Office of Religious Freedom in the Foreign Affairs Ministry of Canada. She is the author most recently of The Challenge of Modernizing Islam. Christine Douglas Williams, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's been entirely too long. I'm so glad to have you join us.
It is a pleasure to talk to you again, Frank.
Well, it is always with some mixed feeling because the news that you usually bring us from Canada is not cheery. And we're watching, as we speak, your Prime Minister Trudeau off to Latvia to strut his stuff as one of the leaders of the defense of Western civilization. But what you recount of what he is doing on the home front is very distressing, especially since the border between our two countries is so porous. Tell us a little bit about the practice that the Trudeau government has engaged in of welcoming home, believe it or not, jihadists who have been fighting for ISIS until recently. What is up with that, Christine?
Frank, if it wasn't so serious, it would be comical. Here you have a prime minister who was questioned in a public forum about a concerned citizen that wanted more funding for our defense, for people, for our great, brave men and women who have fought for the country. And another person decided to ask, well, you're taking away funding there, but you're opening wide our borders to even welcome back not only illegal fighters of ISIS.
Jihadist
fighters. In fact, it's so bad that he went on to say, well, these people could be an incredible, powerful voice. He called them ISIS travelers. This is the term that he used to describe them. And then he got into comparing them to Italian and Greek immigrants. He was saying that his premise is that Canadians who are concerned about these ISIS fighters are somehow, quote, racist and Islamophobic for having concern for their safety. This is absolutely insane. And in addition, the kinds of summer programs this fellow is funding are either related directly to Hamas and other terrorist entities, or they are definitely on the list of unindicted co-conspirators.
Unbelievable. This is all the more striking because, as you've reported at Jihad Watch, Christine Douglas Williams, a judge in Iraq has recently taken to hanging some of these ISIS veterans of British extraction as a means of protecting the United Kingdom from the danger that they would pose were they to return. This seems simply insane. But again, the concern that I think we in this side of the border must have is that anybody welcome back into your country, or for that matter, welcome for the first time to your country, could very well wind up in ours. So this is actually a shared problem for us, is it not? And it goes along with something else we'll be talking momentarily with Sam Westrup of the Middle East Forum about what these Sharia supremacists are doing in the way of sort of civilization jihad, as the Muslim Brotherhood calls it. But talk to us a little bit, if you would, Christine, about the state of play with respect to Canada's efforts to counter so-called Islamophobia, which is what, of course, the Brotherhood calls us who are raising alarms about what they're up to.
Now, the buzzword surrounding Islamophobia is M103, the motion M103. That created fireworks in Canada because M103, to make a long story short, is about Islamophobia. And people try to, in the left-wing media in particular, say, this is not a threat. All it is it's looking at discrimination against Muslims. However, when it was repeatedly offered that the word Islamophobia be exchanged with anti-Muslim bigotry, it was repeatedly rejected. The word Islamophobia, as we know, has a specific meaning.
And that meaning is anybody who gives offense to Islam.
Well, it does. And one of the criticisms was there was no real definition. However, the NCCM, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, who was really CARECAN, did provide a definition about fear and dislike of Islam. So it included this. Now, the follow-up for M103 ended up being such that it was presented in a larger frame of multiculturalism, and $23 million, Frank, of taxpayer money is going toward that action against discrimination and action against Islamophobia. What is so scary about this is that it is based on a misnomer. Now, part of that document with the $23 million, it was actually highlighted that Canadian citizens will also be monitored for compliance. The Public Service Commission of Canada, this is what it said, offers standardized assessment instruments through its personnel psychology center for use by public service organizations. So this is becoming more and more totalitarian, and that Canadians are being monitored for compliance when it comes to Islamophobia, and the NCCM is very much part of that program because they will be recipients of that $23 million, of part of it, as well as IRFAN, which was outlawed as a terrorist entity.
This is really chilling. We'll be speaking a little later in the program with Gordon Chang about a practice that the Chinese totalitarians call a social credit system, which sounds a lot like what you're talking about in terms of monitoring Canadian citizens for their compliance with this kind of thought control. Now, this is taking place in Canada, Christine Douglas-Williams, at the same time that the government of Prime Minister Trudeau is taking steps that are, shall we say, inhospitable to or unfriendly, one might even say, towards Christians. What's going on that front?
He was quoted outright as actually saying by a minister, his name is Minister Long. I believe his first name is Peter, but this is something we can look up. He said openly, it was found on Christian Post, that the Prime Minister has actually said that the worst of Canadian society are evangelical Christians. Not only that, but there was a document that had to be a checkoff for summer jobs program if you wanted to be funded, where you had to check that attestation that you support abortion, rights to abortion. This excluded Christian organizations to the point where Andrew Bennett, the former ambassador for religious freedom, says this is an assault on Christians, and this government is starting to be more and more totalitarian. And he's absolutely right. So while Christian organizations are not getting summer funding, groups like the NCCM, summer programs for youth and education.
Christine Douglas-Williams, we are hard out of time. This is a topic to which we will return soon with you. Thank you for all that you're doing, your work at Jihad Watch and elsewhere. I know you'll keep it up, and I commend once again to all of our listeners your terrific book, The Challenge of Modernizing Islam. Next up, we will be speaking with Sam Westrup, as promised, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm pleased to say joined by Sam Westrup, a man I've admired for some time for his work on tracking and helping the rest of us make sense of what Islamists, or if you will, Sharia supremacists, are up to inside our own country and elsewhere around the world. He does that these days as the head of a terrific project called Islamist Watch at a marvelous organization, the Middle East Forum. He is also a senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. You all are aware of my admiration for that organization as well. He previously served as the research director of another great team, Americans for Peace and Tolerance. He is one of the authors of a very important new report by the Middle East Forum, relatively new. It is entitled Islamic Relief, Charity, Extremism, Terror. Sam Westrop, it's great to have you with us, and I'm very anxious to pick your brains about Islamic Relief among other Muslim Brotherhood front organizations. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this group, Islamic Relief. I think if anybody knows much about it, they're primarily acquainted with what is purportedly its good works around the world, the charitable activities, if you will. But that's not all there is to it, is it?
No, most certainly not. Islamic Relief has built a powerful reputation as a force for international good. It is lauded by governments, by princes, by presidents, by Jewish groups, by faith groups of all kind, non-profit groups of all kind. And yet at the heart of it, as our report finds, this charity is a front for Islamism, for extremism. It is the flagship institution of a very specific Islamist network, the Global Muslim Brotherhood. It is a subsidizer of terror in the Gaza Strip, and it is a promoter of hate speech here in the West, in mosques, community centers, and Islamic schools all across the country.
Hmm. Now, as a charitable organization, it follows what is known under Sharia as zakat, does it not?
Yes. So zakat being, of course, one of the pillars of Islam, is also, well, let's take a specific example already, if you don't mind. In the Gaza Strip, Islamic Relief funds zakat organizations. Now, what these zakat organizations do is they take Muslims, or in this case, Gazans, charitable contributions, and they distribute them to various welfare causes, so funding of schools, orphanages, subsidy of medicine. On the face of it, this sounds wonderful. But zakat is also used under Islamist rule. It is also used as a political endeavor. It is used to justify, it is used to legitimize ruling Islamist power. So, in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood came into power through its exploitation of zakat. In Egypt, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood spread by running the charities, by setting up schools, by getting involved with every area of benevolence that benefited them, that gave them some kind of moral credibility, that gave them political credibility. And it is this aspect of Islam, this politicized benevolence, into which Islamic Relief taps.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but as I understand it, Sam Westrop, of the 8 approved purposes for which zakat may be applied, at least one, and depending on how you define them, perhaps as many as 4 of those prescribed purposes have to do with jihad. And that means the violent kind, not simply the civilization kind practiced by the Muslim Brotherhood in some places like the United States of America, for example. So what we're talking about when governments such as the United States, as you found in your report, have invested $80 million in taxpayer funding over the past 10 years in this group, Islamic Relief, are they not, in fact, as a practical matter, actually investing in jihad on the part of the Sharia supremacist team?
Well, rather than look at the possibility of what Islamic Relief could be funding according to both Islamic and Islamist doctrine, we decided to take a much more practical approach and look entirely at what we know. So we believe what we have in our report is just a fraction of the extent of the problem, a fraction of the truth. But yes, I can say that Islamic Relief, subsidized by the taxpayer to the tune of at least $80 million from Western taxpayers over the last 10 years, is funding zakat organizations or programs across the world that are tied to terror and likely benefit terror.
This has prompted you in your report, Islamic Relief, Charity, Extremism, Terror, Sam Westrop, which can be found in its entirety at meforum.org, to make certain recommendations. Share those with us quickly, if you would.
Yeah, of course. So Islamic Relief benefits not just from taxpayer subsidy, but also from political legitimacy, from media puffery, from the support of faith groups and other partners across the world. We're calling for a complete rejection by all these different stakeholders. We're calling for governments to cut off funding. We're calling for legislators to institute inquiries and to look closer at Islamic Relief activities, both domestically and abroad. We're calling on Jewish groups to stop working with a charity that has so long promoted extremism. We're calling on Christian groups to do the same, and as well as other international aid charities. And anyone who has an interest in humanitarianism without a political agenda, and even more importantly, without a terror agenda, we're calling on them to reject Islamic Relief completely and utterly. Now, that includes international bodies as well, the United Nations, the European Union, the World Health Organization. All these charities are funding and legitimizing this flagship institution of Islamism.
And not least, the United States government ought to be rejecting it as well. And you call, in addition, as I read it, Sam, for the actual shutting down of this operation, do you not?
I do, ultimately. I think it is, I've used this phrase, flagship institution, a few times. I do believe it is the most important Islamist financial institution in the world today. It has branches in around 30 countries around the world. It may have been started by just a few students in the 1980s in a small British city, but now it has the ears of presidents and princes, as I mentioned earlier, you know, European monarchy, President Obama. It is incredibly powerful, incredibly dangerous, and it is subsidizing an incredibly violent idea.
Well, thank you for exposing it for what it is. And it is high time, as you say, that we at least stop contributing to its malevolence, and better yet, preventing it altogether by shutting it down. Speaking of the Muslim Brotherhood and its activities that are inimical to not only our own, well, constitutional freedoms and national and homeland security interests, but those of Western civilization more generally, Sam Westrup. Let me just mention that tomorrow, Congressman Ron DeSantis, the chairman of the National Security Subcommittee of the Government Oversight Committee in the House of Representatives, is holding an important hearing on the Muslim Brotherhood and what it's up to. I hope, in furtherance of legislation that he, among others, has sponsored to try to have it designated as a terrorist organization. But you've studied closely what these guys are up to, and I'd like you to just give us a sense, beyond the charitable operations, what else is the Brotherhood engaged in that comes under the rubric of this this term they've coined called civilization jihad? And what does it mean for countries like ours that often are persuaded to consider all this perfectly legitimate activities under the guise of it being somehow part of a religious practice?
Yes. So the primary method by which the Brotherhood spreads, you know, aside from the charitable means we mentioned and discussed earlier, is anything that is lawful, essentially. So through legislation, through lobbying, through schools, through chaplaincy programs, through community groups, through every kind of civil, societal infiltration one can think of.
Popular culture, not least, academia, finance even.
Indeed. It is a wide gamut of operations. And something the Oversight Committee should be doing is just looking at the extent to which, firstly, the Muslim Brotherhood has carried out this effort in order to impose their leadership on American Muslim communities, many of whom do not actually support the ideas of the global Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, Muslim Brotherhood leaders, especially in American Muslim communities, operate mostly without a mandate. But they have been able to position themselves as leaders precisely because of these efforts to infiltrate civil society, so that government and media turns to them and regards them as representatives of American Muslims. So this is what the Oversight Committee should be looking at on the one hand. And on the other hand, they should be looking at the link between the Muslim Brotherhood, the lawful Islamists, and terror. There is a very key link between lawful extremism and violence. The Muslim Brotherhood is a bridge to terror. It is a gateway drug to terror. And there's a huge amount that can be done looking practically at their influence to gauge how true that is.
Yeah, those are two hugely important points. And I would just say in regard to the latter, Sam Westrup, that it seems to me that the record is pretty clear that the Muslim Brotherhood, while it professes and is often lauded, particularly in Western countries like ours, for having eschewed violence, is perfectly prepared to engage in violence when it thinks it's expedient and can be usefully engaged in, does it not? And secondly, that this organization, as you say, has managed to engage in Sharia supremacism first and foremost within the Muslim community itself, trying to dominate and speak for and thereby further exercise dominion over the Muslims who may, in some cases at least, have come here to get away from Sharia and programs like theirs. Sam, there's so much more to talk about in connection with all of these things. Thank you so much, Sam, for your time today. Come back to us again soon, if you would. It was great to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is with us, I'm pleased to say, virtually at least. We catch up with him just about every week, for which I am extremely grateful. Gordon is, of course, one of our country's preeminent experts on matters involving Asia, and most especially China and North Korea and other, well, increasingly serious dangers posed by such countries to our own. Gordon is the author of two terrific books, one about North Korea, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, the other about China, The Coming Collapse of China. You can find his writings these days at the Daily Beast and elsewhere, and it is always a delight to find him here. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank, and I'm extremely grateful as well.
Let me ask you, Gordon, first and foremost, you've written a rather provocative piece, I have to say, at the Daily Beast, under the headline, Trump's North Korea Policy Has Collapsed. Talk us through why you would make that case. It seems as though, at least from Mike Pompeo's perspective, having recently met with Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang, that would not be so. But tell us why you think it is.
President Trump's North Korea policy is based on a fundamental assumption that Kim Jong-un has made a decision to give up his nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, the satellite imagery suggests otherwise. There have been recent improvements to the 5-megawatt reactor in Yongbin, which produces plutonium. There's no peaceful uses for it. We see the continuing construction at a site that makes parts for solid fuel ballistic missiles. And of course, there were the comments from the North Korean Foreign Ministry on the talks that occurred this weekend when Secretary Pompeo was in Pyongyang. Pompeo gave a glowing assessment of progress on almost every front. At the same time, the North Koreans said the talks were regrettable, accused the U.S. of a gangster-like mindset, and clearly were an attempt to embarrass Pompeo and, in fact, the United States. Unfortunately, the administration has given North Korea a number of concessions, which means time is working against us. So, for instance, we are not vigorously going forward with sanctions, despite what Pompeo says. And by the way, he does need to be more candid with the American people, because we're not designating the new front companies, which means that North Korea, because it changes front companies all the time, is being allowed to hollow out the sanctions. And we're not going after the Chinese and Russians for blatant sanctions violations. Also, we have suspended large-scale exercises with South Korea. But President Trump did not get a reciprocal promise from Kim to suspend his summer training cycle. So therefore, our readiness is declining while North Korea's is increasing. This is a very disturbing story, Frank.
It is indeed. Especially two things come to mind, Gordon. One, that what we are seeing, as you say, and monitoring with overhead reconnaissance, is obviously only a fraction of what the North Koreans are actually doing, with much of their nuclear weapons and other military activities concealed deep underground. It's almost certainly the case that there's a lot more activity there that's underway as well. And secondly, Gordon, I would ask you to comment on the extent to which South Korea, our partners in those exercises have begun championing a deal on terms very much less robust than what has been laid out by the administration, including by Mike Pompeo as recently as his visit to Pyongyang, of a comprehensive, irreversible, and verifiable denuclearization of the North.
Yeah. Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is virulently anti-American and pro-North Korean. He has advisors who in their youth advocated the overthrow of the South Korean government by North Korea. And although young people say things that they would often like to take back, Moon's advisors have not disavowed their earlier activities and comments. President Trump is not responsible for Moon, and Trump's diplomacy with regard to South Korea last year was tactically brilliant. So I think Trump gets a lot of credit for trying to rein in Moon, but we've got to understand that right now we have a South Korea that is just not our friend, that is working to undermine the goals of denuclearization, disarmament, and this is a constant challenge for the Trump administration.
Yeah, it sort of probably causes most Americans to scratch their heads about what's going on with the South Koreans. After all, isn't it at least as much in their interest to denuclearize the North as it is in ours? And for them to be, as you say, undermining the president is a peculiar thing, but it makes sense if, as you say, their president is pretty much playing for the other team. Let me ask you, Gordon, to the extent that the president's policies are founded on a misapprehension about Kim Jong-un's intentions, what would you recommend he be doing at this point?
Well, first of all, the president should not be sending out tweets saying that he has trust in Kim Jong-un. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And President Trump is starting, I think, to own the problem. I mean, it's starting to become responsible for the problem. What we have to do is, first of all, go after North Korea. The sanctions need to be vigorously enforced. We need to impose severe costs on Beijing, especially for busting the sanctions. We need to go after the Chinese banks for money laundering. Whatever we think our North Korea policy should be, we should not allow anyone to launder cash through New York. And that's what we've been allowing China to do. And this is not just a Trump problem. Previous administrations have known about this and not done anything. So this is an American disease right now, and we need to cure it immediately. Also, we need to resume those large-scale exercises with South Korea. And I think that the United States needs to play to the South Korean public, because most people in South Korea, of course, want to retain their democracy. They don't want to be absorbed by North Korea. This is an opportunity for the United States to win over the South Korean population, which should be an easy thing to do.
Let me ask you, Gordon, you mentioned the Chinese are not enforcing the sanctions against North Korea at this point. I think increasingly it's evident, as you've been warning for some time, that they are encouraging Kim Jong-un to, well, either back away from or simply ignore the kinds of undertakings that he previously made with President Trump on denuclearization. This seems to be fitting a pattern that you describe in a really brilliant article in a magazine that I don't have much use for, frankly, American Conservative. But you've laid out quite comprehensively, Gordon, what you call Xi Jinping's great leap backwards. Backwards to not just a sort of Maoist totalitarianism, but actually to a pattern of behavior very much reminiscent of some of China's historic imperialist traditions. Walk us through all of that, if you would.
Xi Jinping has been using Maoist language, but more concerning, he's been using language of the imperial era, where China had a Tianxia, or all under heaven, system, where the Chinese emperor was the only legitimate sovereign in the world, and everyone else had to pay tribute to the celestial court. Xi Jinping, for about a decade, has been using Tianxia language about how all the people in the world are one family. And it's gotten to a point where he's more than just hinting. Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, in September of last year, wrote an article in Study Times, which is an authoritative publication. And he said that Xi Jinping's thought, and thought is a important body of work in Communist Party lingo, that Xi Jinping thought on international relations transcended and replaced 300 years of Western international relations theory. What he was referring to was the Treaty of Westphalia, which underpins today's system of relations among states, establishes the notions of competing sovereigns. In other words, when you put all of Xi Jinping's language together, and his actions, by the way, Xi Jinping is making the case that only China is sovereign and that the rest of us are tributes. This is extremely dangerous, it's ludicrous, it's breathtaking, but nonetheless, we should not ignore what Xi Jinping is in fact telling us.
Yeah, and it comes at a time when, as you've pointed out in this article and elsewhere, I have to say, Gordon Chang, that Xi is engaged in a transformation of his own government from what might have been called the authoritarian collective system to a one-man totalitarian rule, effectively. This has implications, of course, both for the people of China, but also for the rest of us, does it not?
Oh, well, certainly. You know, just by background, many people say that China is authoritarian. China actually is moving back to a totalitarian state, and we see this with surveillance and coercive mechanisms. And, of course, this has implications for us because China is trying to censor our discussions about China and matters of domestic political interest and not relating to China. So this is China trying to interfere in our political system and in our discourse. And this is something which is, of course, completely unacceptable. We have to go after all foreign interference in our domestic affairs, not just Russian.
Yeah. Gordon, let me ask you to dwell for a moment on that first point, though. The degree to which China is using expansive and increasingly sophisticated technical surveillance to create something called the social credit system is 1984 on steroids, isn't it? And I was talking earlier in the program with Christine Douglas Williams about some steps that it seems even the Canadians are now taking in this regard. Talk to us about what the implications of this are, again, perhaps both for China and for other nations that might be interested in modeling themselves after its increasingly totalitarian system.
The social credit system score in China is breathtaking because there are constantly updated scores for every Chinese resident. And so, for instance, whatever you post on social media, whether you jaywalk, whatever you say about the Communist Party, whatever you do affects your credit score. And if your score is low enough, you can't send your children to school. You can't buy a ticket for to get on a plane. There's all sorts of things that you cannot do. What China's been able to do with technology is to marry photographic, you know, surveillance cameras along with intrusions into the media, along with being able to understand every keystroke on your computer.
Gordon Chang, thank you for the great work you do and for spending time with us each week. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Kevin Freeman, one of our duty experts on economic warfare, a subject about which he has written extensively, including two best-selling books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He also is the driving force behind a terrific online resource, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and the star of a new television production, Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, we talked at some length with Gordon Chang about what the Chinese are up to, but we didn't cover a topic that I know you're following closely. So let me get into that with you. The trade war is evidently on now, officially, with Communist China. The president has announced something on the order of, I gather, $30-odd billion worth of tariffs, and the Chinese have reciprocated in kind and in amount. Give us your sit-rep, if you will, situation report, Kevin, on how that is shaping up at the moment.
Well, there's no doubt that China and the United States are encountering some level of trade friction, trade war. The reality of it is it's not much of a trade war in one sense, and that is we export about $120 billion or so annually to the Chinese, and we import over $500 billion. So, you know, in that respect, we've been in a trade war and we've been losing for decades. But the problem that we're facing is essentially that China is not playing fair. They have not followed any of the rules. They want to be treated as an emerging nation, and yet the reality of it is they are the second largest economy in the world, and some argue the largest if you adjust for purchasing power parity. And so from that perspective, they want the kitty prices and the kitty rules, but they are exerting influence as a major player.
Yeah, big-time adult. And to the extent that the argument is now being made that when we impose tariffs on their imports to this country, we are effectively taxing exports to their country, if only because of the effect that their tariffs on our imports there represent. Is this likely to end well, as you see it? Especially, as we've discussed in the past, Kevin Freeman, if the Chinese are going to use tools in other kits rather than tariffs to try to exact a price from us for engaging in a tariff-focused kind of, you know, counteraction on their trade war of many years, as you say.
Well, I think that's the critical thought. The critical realization is that we've been in an economic war with China, and recognizing it in the trade arena, you can't do that on an isolated basis. Oh, we're just going to talk about trade. They have been stealing our intellectual property. They've been hacking our economy. You have to recognize it in the broader picture. They're using all means of economic warfare against the United States.
Unrestricted warfare, as you've called it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talk about using small responses in the trade context, and everybody throws up their arms and is all excited and all upset that we're doing something wrong. And then the arguments made, as you alluded to in the Wall Street Journal, there's an article that says U.S. exporters will be a surprise loser from tariff fight. But the reality, again, is we just don't export that much to China. 120 billion versus 500 billion. And so there may be some impact on that 120 billion, but it is relatively small in comparison to the much larger impact that they're having in the trillions that they're stealing through cyber hacking, intellectual property theft, and so forth, as well as the half a trillion that they're selling us on a regular basis.
Right. And Kevin, what do you say to people who point to the impact that restricting imports effectively through tariffs will have on companies that rely on not Chinese finished products, but components for the manufacture of what are otherwise American-made items? Is that likely to cause a ripple effect through our economy that isn't obviously included in that import versus export calculation that you've mentioned now?
Well, quite possibly it will have, in fact, quite likely we're going to have that negative impact. But the reality of it is we're in an economic war. And if it'd be making the same argument in the 1940s, for example, well, aren't you importing from Germany? Isn't that going to hurt to cut off imports? Until the Chinese start treating us fairly and start acting appropriately, they are one of the greatest global risks that we face. And even when we do import things from them, how do we know that they're not compromised? So the point being is, until we wake up to the reality that this is a global economic war, all of these things may be at risk, but they're small in comparison to the greater risk of, if we continue down the current path, the devastating consequences that we could face.
Understood. Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Kevin Freeman, that is, again, evidence of a possible other line of attack for the Chinese in retaliation for President Trump's tariffs. A kind of currency war, you've called it. What's going on that front? And if you would, tell us how they could possibly be engaging in such a currency war, depreciating their currency in the process, and still advance their objective of trying to encourage the world to adopt their currency rather than ours as the world's reserve currency.
Well, currencies strengthen or weaken for one of a couple of reasons. One of them is simply the strength or weakness of an economy. And China's economy has had numerous bubbles, housing bubbles and investment bubbles and so forth, that are potentially bursting. And that weakness is generally how, one way you offset that is you depreciate your currency. And so by doing that, you can increase the opportunity for export. People will buy your manufactured goods at lower prices, and therefore you'll increase your market share. But there's a second component, which is the manipulation of currency for economic warfare purposes. And you want to be able to have the flexibility to go either direction. Now, in the world today, we hope that we have a stable currency regime to where people are not manipulating the currency one direction or the other. And that applies to the major nations of the world. China has exempted itself from that, has asked to be treated as an emerging nation, and therefore has maintained greater control. They pegged their currency to the dollar, and in so doing, they've been a part of the world system. But now the talk is that they may allow that band to dip to where they no longer maintain that tie to the dollar, which would increase their ability to export goods. It would make imports more expensive, and exports would be more attractive. And so they've been doing that. And they can do that in the short term while still maintaining the long-term approach of we want to remove the dollar as the primary reserve currency. Those aren't incongruent. Those can happen simultaneously, that they're setting up the systems in place to remove the dollar of the world's reserve currency and to make China a reserve currency. At the same time, they can weaken it in the short term in order to gain an export advantage or in order to move the world economy a certain direction.
Fascinating stuff, and the kind of thing that made economics not only a dismal science, but one that eluded me, I have to say, both at undergraduate and graduate levels. Let me ask you, Kevin, for clarity on one other point. The president is off, as you know, to NATO, where he will meet, among others, with Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany. She just recently had a tete-a-tete with Xi Jinping, the dictator of communist China, in which they both agreed that what the United States was doing was not consistent with what they called a rule-based free trade system. Kevin, based on what you've already said, I think I know the answer, but what do you think is the practice of China and, for that matter, Germany, when it comes to free trade, rule-based or otherwise?
What we have to keep in mind is that the world's rules-based system gets ridiculous at the extremes. And what we've been facing is essentially a system that shackles the United States because we're the world's largest and strongest economy, and it benefits the other nations of the world. And so at points, you have to just upset those rules. One good example that Rick Santelli described is that sometimes when you have to upset the rules in labor relations, people go against their economic interests, and sometimes people go on strike. They do it basically driving their income to zero during the period of the strike, but with the hope that they can get a better deal on the other side. If you look at it objectively in the short term, you say, why would anybody give up getting paid to not get paid? And the United States, we've got to step out of the system a little bit and say, wait a minute, everybody else is violating the rules of the system, and we're not going to continue.
Kevin Freeman, thank you for clarifying so many of these really important points on the economic warfare front. We thank you for your time. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk, I hope, to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.